On Tuesday lunchtime, as I was driving between two appointments, I was listening to Jeremy Vine on Radio 2. The young people in our house will tell you that the radio is always on Radio 2 in my car because I'm apparently boring. The Jeremy Vine show is sometimes the show that actually challenges me to keep listening, as his discussion topics are often frustrating and those who phone in occasionally challenging. However, on Tuesday, the possibility of a universal basic income was being discussed. At first, the discussion seemed to carry the utopian ideals of a Star Trek episode. I was never an expert in Star Trek until I got married. And in Star Trek, you discover that financial recompense for individual contribution to society is no longer important, no longer significant. And instead, people are valued for who they are and the variety of skills they might bring to any situation. However, Jeremy Vine wasn't talking about Star Trek. He was instead focusing on an experiment that has been happening in Finland. It began in January 2017 when 200 unemployed people between the ages of 25 and 58 were given a monthly sum of around £500. It's a two-year trial. And during this, none of those in receipt of the award are required to accept or seek employment. The first year seems to have engendered interesting experiences. One of those taking part, who'd hoped to start his own business, has found the starting of the business almost impossible because they've become the focus of media attention and have spent more time talking about the scheme than doing what they hoped to do. The behavioural and social specialists who instigated the trial have had to remind people that a full trial would have to target a variety of groups and not just the unemployed, and that would investigate different levels of payment while looking at local factors. This trial, instead, is an opportunity to see how unconditional income affected the employment of the unemployed. The sum of money involved is roughly equivalent to what might have been given in unemployment benefit. The discussion on the programme interviewed someone who had instigated the trial and someone who was participating. So far, it would appear that some of those who are in receipt of the money feel liberated from the expectations of appearing at job centres and searching for training courses. Instead, they feel independent and more intuitive to what their own education and training needs might be. It's inspired those who are creative to develop their particular talents and turn them into developing businesses. The person in receipt of the universal basic income that had been involved in the manufacturing industry had been made redundant, and he discovered that having the grant had allowed him to be creative, and he had a small woodcrafting studio in a garden shed and was selling pieces of his own work. It was almost impossible for him to get back into the sphere of manufacturing from which he'd been made redundant, but he was finding a purpose and an income beyond what he was being given by doing something that he enjoyed and he was skilled to do. In January, the Guardian newspaper also ran an article on the Finnish experiment. I don't read the Guardian very often. And while recognising the flaws in the trial that was happening, it hinted at the possibility that such a trial may have to be further developed as automation threatened a third of current jobs in the West. So one day, we may all have to rely on a universal income. The story captured my thoughts as I began to think about what the next 3 weeks of preaching might hold. Once again this summer, we're leaving behind the traditional pattern of following the lectionary and stepping into a theme. And so for the next 3 weeks, we will be thinking about generosity and stewardship. I'm going to do that through sub-themes of worry, grief, and fear. And each week in the Gospel text, we will be thinking about treasure in heaven and how that treasure is portrayed within the practicalities of earthly living. And so we start with Matthew's Gospel this week. The Swiss theologian Ulrich Lues suggests that any superficial reading of this passage would have followers thinking that it was written by a single man living a carefree life on a Galilean beach. The world we think we hear in these words seems out of step with the world in which we live. Where are the responsibilities? We can't all down tools and sit around watching the world. Because if we do, who shares in the stewardship of the earth and the care of creation? But we need to dig deeper and think about the passage we hear today to walk away with a better understanding. Do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. To hear these words calling us to a different way of living has us wrestling with who were the original audience. We're dropping into a passage, a story, partway through, so we're not aware of where the conversation's begun and who's listening. But it's a continuation of the Sermon on the Mount that began in chapter 5, that lovely passage about blessed are, and that continues right through to chapter 7. This means that it's most likely to have been teaching offered to those who were considered disciples, not just the 12, but those who had become part of the wider group, following Jesus through town and village. The teaching we have here in one section may not have originally all been together, and instead those who've compiled the gospel have brought a series of texts together to form one continuous conversation, grouped together by theme. The audience may well have included fishermen, lawyers, tax collectors, thieves, women, people who'd fallen out with their rabbis, probably much like any Sunday morning congregation. The fundamental message for those who would be leaving behind livelihoods was that the reassurance was to place your trust in God. The deeper message, though, was about shaping a community that lived in knowledge and trust of God, at times with different values to the society in which it was placed. In entrusting life to God, disciples were to wonder at the abundance of God rather than limit themselves to the scarcity of the world. Jesus challenges all who hear his words to think about how they're shaping their lives. Are we shaped by the values of the world in which we live? Do we measure our worth in terms of money and belongings? Or are we shaped by the love of God? Do we recognize that there's no measurement of worth? Because the divine nature is to live unconditionally and beyond imagination. For generations, we have used counting as a measurement of our worth within Christian faith, as an expression of how we understand the crucifixion and the resurrection. Did you notice? If you think about the theologies of the atonement, the trying to understand the reconciliation of God and humanity through Jesus Christ, all of these, or many of these, have focused on the importance of being revalued as humanity. The traditional understanding of the atonement speaks of Jesus' death as paying the debt of our sin. We are revalued and found worthy through death. However, there is a different interpretation, a different possibility of understanding atonement, a different way of understanding what the death and resurrection mean for us as Christian people. One that suggests that those in power were so invested in a world of scarcity that the abundance that Jesus promised from God was threatening and frightening. It's an interpretation that moves the focus to the fullness of God and the lacking of our understanding. In his commentary on this passage, David Lewes writes, God doesn't operate from scarcity. God operates out of abundance. So in response to the crucifixion of God's Son, God does not, in fact, keep track or look for payment or hoard power with which to destroy the offenders. Instead, God resurrects, which, when you think about it, is the ultimate act of abundance, creating something once again out of nothing, drawing light from darkness, giving life to the dead. Jesus' words act as an invitation to view our world differently. Whenever media images or society projects a world where scarcity is the overriding message, the community of followers is to look for a way in which the abundance of God might come to the fore. It's not an easy invitation because it asks us to move our focus from ourselves and our own wee world to see the bigger picture. It challenges us to live with the glass half full rather than trying not to drink from the almost empty glass. Government, media, advertisers settle us with the news that resources are limited. But perhaps we need to hear Gandhi's reminders that the world has enough for everyone's needs, but not enough for everyone's greed. Living as the followers will mean knowing the pain of the psalmist in Psalm 51, the psalm we began this morning with, the psalm, part of the psalm that Alison read, who speaks of failing to live as inspired by God, and yet trusting that God recognizes the richness of the possibility within us all. In practical terms, what does that mean? It means being involved in our communities, church and town, and enjoying the moments where we see no need to worry. Allowing our eye to fall upon the moments, people and places that offer signs of the divine presence continuing to create. And it also means recognizing the difficulties of our world and attempting to change the narrative of scarcity to a narrative of abundance. Difficult, I know, when it comes to thinking about funding for the NHS or for teaching or finding resources to feed people in other lands, of offering homes for the whole world. Yet even in these difficulties, we're to search out the stories and people that speak of abundant living that enriches life and perhaps encourages others and ourselves to focus on those models as possibilities for others. Even in those difficulties, we are to revalue, to rediscover that we have enough, and to trust that others may share in the enough that we have. At the very least, as this is a sermon supposedly on stewardship, perhaps our hope should be that we stop worrying about what we have in comparison to others and enjoy the wealth of who we are and what we have, knowing that what we have, what we need, is given by God. And what we're given by God grows when shared with others. As I was sitting writing last night, the same chorus kept running through my head, and I'm not singing today. I'll leave you to sing it on your way home, because once it's in your head, it's not going to leave. Perhaps you sang it in Sunday school. Love is something, if you give it away, you end up having more. When we allow ourselves to enjoy God's created world, we're renewed and enabled, even just to tell the story of what we have seen and what we have done. To revel in those moments of God's love and the abundance we have found in it. And then as we share it, as we offer those around us a new vision and excitement for Christ's presence in our world, only then do we allow what we understand of God's love to grow and for us to bathe in the abundance of that love. Because only when it is shared do we ever notice the fullness of all we have been given. Amen.